I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Whose face is on the $5 bill? I'm going to make it easy for you. Lincoln. If you look at a $5 bill, that image, coincidentally, is based on a photograph that was taken on the very same day an escape tunnel was completed for one of the greatest escapes in American history. We are about to hear a Civil War story that really does qualify as mind-boggling. And to imagine what happened, we're going to be visiting a place called Libby Prison in Richmond, Virginia. And here to tell the story is award-winning writer and historian Robert P. Watson. He's a prolific author, and among his titles, Escape, the story of the Confederacy's infamous Libby Prison and the Civil War's largest jailbreak. He's on the line with us right now. Robert Watson, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Marcus. It's a real pleasure to be on the show with you.
You know, there's so many different places this could begin, but I thought maybe we should start with tobacco, because tobacco curiously figures into this prison story.
It does. So the prison was located in Richmond, as you noted, and of course Richmond is the capital of the Confederacy after it was moved at the beginning of the Civil War from Montgomery, and it was located right along the James River. The James River is the lifeblood of not only Richmond, but it would turn out to be the lifeline for the entire Confederacy, because the tobacco and other agricultural products would flow from the James down into the Potomac, Chesapeake, and then out to the Atlantic to the world. So it was a very strategic and important location known as Tobacco Row. And what would become this wretched Confederate prison started off as three warehouses to warehouse tobacco right there along the edge of the James River. That's how it got its start in the 1850s, a decade before the Civil War.
Well, in a way, I guess this makes sense, that if you don't know that suddenly you're going to have a Civil War, that you don't know that there will be hundreds, thousands of prisoners, you're not going to have any facility ready for them.
Yeah, you know, both the North and the South severely underestimated everything about the war. There were prominent newspapers in both parts of the country saying that the war would last a month. Some Northerners said, because we have the advantage of what I always call the three M's, more money, manufacturing, and more men, that the war would easily be over in 30 to 90 days. In fact, they had enlistments for only that long. Whereas Confederate leaders said, because we have the better generals and the more ornery troops, it's only a matter of us marching to engage them and the war will be over. Little did they know. So both sides completely underestimated the horrors that would happen. 620,000 men would die during the Civil War, which is more than World War I and World War II put together in terms of American losses. And consequently, at the beginning of the war, neither side has enough prisons. Neither side has officials ready for the prisons. Neither side has deals worked out for prisoner exchanges, much less food, guards, and so on. So both the North and the South are desperately looking for prisons. The South decides to convert some of those massive tobacco warehouses and factories along the James River, like Libby, into prisons. So that's kind of how it gets started.
Now, I get the gist that the Libby prison is kind of a central prison in a way, something like a clearinghouse for at some point. I mean, it ramps up to being that.
Correct. Yeah, it ends up being perhaps the most important prison of the entire Civil War for the Confederacy. For much of the war, every single prisoner, every single Northern prisoner captured, including spies, including members of legislatures, politicians, including Southerners that were disloyal, they were all taken to Libby to be processed. So it was the central processing point for the entire war. That ended up only adding to the problems, because you have Richmond becomes a city of prisoners at one point, so many so that there weren't enough guards, so many so that local residents were worried that if there was a prison breakout, they would overrun the entire city. And the Richmond couldn't get enough food in to accommodate all the prisoners. So most prisoners during the war, at one point or another, walked through Libby. If they were high-ranking officers, then they would be imprisoned in Libby. Others were processed and then shipped out to other prisons, both in Virginia and around the South.
Now, there's this one little detail that really interests me where you mention that Luther Libby, who owned the warehouse, was given just 48 hours to vacate that to allow it to become a prison. And the reason I want to mention that is because you've already kind of made it clear that this was just an ad hoc facility. It was not built as a prison. Could you elaborate on what that really meant for the individual prisoner's experience?
Yeah, so it's not built to be a prison, which had its pros and cons. On the one hand, it has several large rooms, 105 feet by about 45 feet with low ceilings. So there's no beds. There's no place to lie down. People are just literally warehouses if they were bales of tobacco. The other problem is there's big open windows, so if it's snowing or raining or the wind's blowing, the prisoners are subject to the elements. The problem for the Confederacy is since it's a warehouse, it's not an ideal place to guard. What they did do was put bars in the window, in all the windows, lock down, bolt all the doors. They painted the lower part of the prison white, so if any prisoners trying to sneak out, they'd be silhouetted against that. And then, of course, they posted guards in the perimeter at all hours around the prison. So it posed problems both ways. Luther Libby was given just a few hours to vacate, which demonstrates the fact that the South really had no idea what it was doing. It was just haphazardly grabbing facilities because there were, it was not uncommon after a battle to have hundreds, potentially thousands of prisoners brought into Richmond, and they had no idea what to do with them. So they just haphazardly picked this prison and started piling it up with prisoners. The other thing that they did with that prison was the South was running out of food, medicine, clothing, everything, which made the conditions for Southern citizens abysmal. The Confederate Army, the troops weren't eating every day. There are accounts of some Confederate soldiers being captured and actually being happy to be captured because they got some basic medical attention and a meal each day. So most of the prisoners that were brought into Libby were robbed. Their blue jackets were taken. The quality of Northern clothing was better. And the South ran out of everything. So they were robbed, which meant that the prisoners were sometimes basically in their long johns, freezing to death in the middle of the winter. No blanket, no nothing. However, when those prisoners did later escape, it helped them because virtually, everybody in Richmond was walking around wearing blue uniforms to some extent because they robbed so many thousands upon thousands of Union prisoners when they came to Libby.
Now, I don't even know how to get into this next issue, but it's a very important one, and it has to do with the level of cruelty of the guards. I would imagine that as you go about trying to size this up, you're going to have narratives, you're going to have different accounts and eyewitnesses, mm-hmm. the guards themselves. There are prisons across the spectrum. Some are detention centers. Others are concentration camps. How would you talk about the treatment of the prisoners?
Yeah, Marcus, this is the disturbing part of the book. One truism, no matter the culture, the country, the period and time throughout history, all societies have done their level worst when it comes to prisoners. The inhumanity with which we treat one another, and we've seen this from the Nazis and the Japanese during World War II to even, Abu Ghraib and other things by the Americans, just the level of inhumanity. And so it was in Richmond. And I think it was particularly bad at Libby, one, because it was high-ranking Union officers. Two, it's the prison is sitting right along Tobacco Row, the center of the Confederate capital, not far from where Jefferson Davis governed. But as guards are starving, as family members are losing loved ones, with the Civil War, every family, North and South, lost a son. Every town lost a native son. So frustrations are built up. People are starving. People are hungry. And the guards sure took it out on the prisoners. And I say this with all due respect because I've written a book on the Holocaust. But some of the conditions, some of the images just reminded me of the Holocaust with prisoners being beaten, being tortured, being denied food, being denied health care, literally lying on their sides, on this hardwood floor, freezing in the middle of the winter. And the warden at one point is screaming at a prisoner to get up and starts kicking him. and then realizes, my gosh, I've been kicking a dead man. There were so many prisoners. They were so overcrowded in the prison that if a disease hit the prison, it was just overrun, and countless men were afflicted or died from the disease. So many so that outside of the prison, they had a space they called the dead house, where they just piled up bodies, and the bodies piled up faster than they could be carted away to be buried. And the men, even, they were so crowded, and it was so cold at night because they didn't have jackets or blankets or anything, that they would get in these long lines, and they would spoon, like a newlywed couple or something. And there would be hundreds and hundreds of men in a room lined up spooning on their right side. And then every hour, their commander would yell, you know, attention, turn side, spoon left. And they would all roll over because they were so jam-packed. If they didn't do that, they'd be literally on top of one another. And it kept them warm. And thirdly, they were skin and bones. So lying on the hardwood floor on one side of your body created health problems, so they had to keep rolling over so that their bodies wouldn't go numb. Just to give you a sense of, and that's probably, those are probably some of the lightest details in terms of the treatment inside Libby.
Is there, I'm getting ahead of the game here in terms of, but is there any evidence of where that place was today? Anything still standing there?
Regrettably, no. Richmond falls on April 2nd, 1865. And as Davis and the Confederates are leaving it, they burn their city to the ground. You know, if we can't have it, no one will. Libby survived that, thank goodness, because there were a few folks still in the prison. Most were moved out by then. 2 days later, in April, Lincoln enters the town, and he wants to visit with Confederate leaders to try to negotiate, but most of the Confederate leaders had fled. But one of the things Lincoln does is he visits Libby. And as he does, a crowd of people start screaming, tear it down, because of the suffering and inhumanity. You know, the blood and mayhem was seemed to be soaked into the wood, into the core of the building. And Lincoln says, no, leave it. It needs to be a reminder, a memorial for what happened here. Unfortunately, a few years after the war, Libby was torn down. A group of investors from Chicago took it literally brick by brick by train all the way to Chicago and built the Libby Civil War Museum with cannons inside and sort of a castle look, and they reconstructed part of the prison. It was successful for a few years, but then they ran out of money, and the bricks, the contents, pretty much everything was either sold or given away. So piecemeal, there's a brick sitting in a little museum in Ohio. There's a barred window in a museum in Richmond, and around the country there's a handful of artifacts, a few in Chicago, but tragically it doesn't exist anymore, and there's no massive exhibit, some place where people could go to either learn about it, to pay respects, or to attract attention of the public. And if you go to, in fact, I was just there this past weekend, I went to the actual site of Libby again. I was back in Richmond promoting the book and doing research for another book, and there's no one around. And I frequently will ask a passerby, a jogger, or someone walking their dog, if they know what was here, they know what this little plaque was. There's a little plaque that says this was the site of Libby Prison. And I've never had anybody say they've even heard of it. So it's largely, if not almost completely, been forgotten. And yet it was one of the most wretched prisons in history and one of the most important prisons during the Civil War.
One of the things we enjoy doing, enjoy is a hard verb to use here, but on this show, is putting places back on the map that are important places.
Yep.
You know, this is very important to know where it is. And I'm glad there's at least a plaque there. I mean, but something more has got to happen, don't you think?
Yeah, without doubt. I guess the only poetic positive aspect of it is on the grounds where the prison sat. Part of the grounds, it's just, dirt and a small road. But part of it is the Virginia Holocaust Museum. So in a way, I suppose it's fitting that a memorial to something so horrific as the Holocaust sits on the ground of, you know, holy ground, sacred ground. And I think part of the reason why, and, you know, there's many reasons why I'm happy to talk to you today, but I guess one of the things is, one of my biggest takeaways was that this prison was used for propaganda. You know, it's disturbing, Marcus, to think that people can treat one another this way, yet alone at one point, the Northerners and Southerners were brothers. You know, we were fellow Americans, and yet we treated one another, we tortured one another, and just murdered one another in prisons like this. But Libby was used for propaganda. The Confederates did not try to keep it quiet what was going on in there. Rather, they wanted the news broadcast, hoping that Union officers, if they heard about how horrific Libby was, it would deter them from picking up arms against them. It would put fear into them. Long story short, it kind of had the opposite effect and became almost a rallying cry, sort of a latter version of Remember the Alamo. But it was also used as propaganda for the Confederacy. And that is Libby, the prisoners called it the Libby Zoo. The wardens and officials in the city would allow Southerners to tour the prison and almost like a zoo and look at the prisoners as if they were animals behind a bar. And they took delight in seeing a famous Union general or colonel that was the hero of a battle now reduced to skin and bones and lying in his feces on the ground, whereupon the visitors to the quote-unquote Libby Zoo would laugh and mock them. And it was meant to make, I guess, the Confederacy feel good about themselves and that they're somehow winning the war. So it was used at this diabolical purpose as a propaganda part of the overall war effort.
Everything you have said paints such a picture that the need to escape is absolutely manifest now. We're going to take a break and then come back and conclude our conversation with Robert Watson, historian and writer of Escape, the story of the Confederacy's infamous Libby Prison and the Civil War's largest jailbreak. Stay tuned to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. We're visiting with historian Robert Watson. He is author of so many books, among them Escape, the story of the Confederacy's infamous Libby Prison and the Civil War's largest jailbreak. It's time to talk about the tunnel. And there are so many tunnel escape stories. And in a way, the story is you dig a tunnel, you get out, or you don't. Is it that simple?
Yeah, you know, we've all probably seen the movie on Escape from Alcatraz with Clint Eastwood, you know, digging out, or seen the great World War II film, The Great Escape, when Roger Bushnell and a bunch of Allied soldiers dug a couple tunnels out. But this was probably the most impressive tunnel and the largest break. What happened was by the winter of 63-64, so by January, February of 1864, the prisoners knew they were done. The Confederacy had largely run out of food, so there were days when nobody had anything to eat. They ran out of medicine. The death toll was spiking. Diseases were tearing through the prison. So it was hopeless. The prisoners realized that they were all going to die. It was not if, but when, just a slow, miserable death. So something had to be done. At the same time, the Confederacy stopped prisoner exchanges. So there was no hope of an exchange. Philanthropic groups would send boxes and mail to the prisoners. The Confederacy cut off boxes of goods and mail. And some Confederate officers, like Nathan Bedford Forrest, stopped even taking prisoners and would just murder people in cold blood when they tried to surrender. So it was just a matter of when they died. That's what motivated, in particular, two of the prisoners, Colonel Thomas Rose from Pennsylvania and a Major Andrew Hamilton from Kentucky. Both of these guys, I mean, their story, it reads like a novel, reads like an action movie, the way they came up with this escape. One night, these two know that they're done. So they, Rose is a big, burly man, a bear of a man with a big beard. It's a stormy night, and there's scaffolding outside of a window. So he knows that the Confederate guards were working on the prison. It started raining so hard that they all ran and left the scaffolding up. So he sneaks to the window, and he's trying to figure out if he can squeeze out or jump to the scaffolding. While he's standing there in pitch blackness in this horrific storm, a lightning bolt strikes and illuminates the area. Right next to him is in the face of another man, and it scared the you-know-what out of both of them. It's Hamilton. Both Rose and Hamilton had the exact same idea the same night at the same time. They shook hands and snuck back to bed. A few nights later, they both managed to get into the basement and they realized that maybe they could tunnel out of the basement. Neither one knew the other was there. As they're down in the basement, they bump into one another, and there they are again. So they shook hands and decided they would tunnel out together. So they proceeded to steal implements and dig this massive tunnel underground out of the prison, across the prison yard into freedom. And of course, it takes weeks. It's a Herculean effort. And the only time they can dig is in the middle of the night, because during the day there's roll calls. The problem then is they're not sleeping. They're not eating. So the men are dying. So it's literally a race against death to get this tunnel dug.
Now, in this story, and I think at the other end of the tunnel, we ought to set the stage for what's going to happen. There's some angel of mercy, a Southern belle, who is very sympathetic to the prisoners.
Yeah, I love this story. So it was obvious that the Union had a spy inside Richmond, and someone had probably placed someone in Jefferson Davis's Confederate White House. It's possible that someone had placed someone inside Libby, and it would turn out that there was a spy in both those places. It seemed that somebody was helping prisoners to escape and running a slave, former slaves running a ring of information to General Butler and General Grant and other Union generals. So there's this, you know, everybody's looking for who this person was. It would turn out to be a woman, and an old woman, Elizabeth Van Loo. They called her Crazy Bet. Her family had been Quakers from Philadelphia, so she grew up as an abolitionist, never married, lived in probably the largest home up on Church Hill, the beautiful hill that sits atop Richmond overlooking the city. And she risked her life daily to help the prisoners to escape. She freed slaves, taught them to read and write, and let them live with her. They would encrypt and decrypt messages. The Union even sent her a codex to use to, the Enigma machine almost, to code messages. They taught her how to write with lemon juice, and when it was heated up, then it would appear. She would take food down to the prison. And, of course, the guards and the wardens are starving to death, literally starving. So here comes this woman with all this baked goods. So she would say, look, I'll give you all this, but you have to give some to the prisoners. They agreed. Underneath the goods that she would give to the prisoner, in the bowl, there was a secret compartment with notes. Or she would hollow out eggs, and there would be a note stuffed in the bottom of the egg at the bottom of the bowl. And she's giving them information on where the Union lines are, when to escape, if they could make it to this intersection. One of her former slaves would be there who would help the person to escape. So Crazy Bet plays like she's crazy. And, of course, no one pays a woman any mind in a sexist society back then. No one pays a crazy woman any mind. All the while, she's probably the most valuable Union spy in the Confederate capital and ends up helping these men to break out.
Does she ever pay a price for her complicity with the enemy?
She sure does. Her life is threatened at the end of the war. When people realize what she did, right at the end, there's a mob that's going to burn her house down. She actually brings her favorite horse into the house because she's worried they're going to kill her horse. She has a horse living in the house with her. Upstairs, hidden in the secret compartment, are a bunch of Union soldiers. But she marches out on the porch and yells at everybody that General Grant is on his way, and if anybody touches her or her house, there's going to be hell to pay. And she talks the mob down. She pretty much loses everything she had. And is persona non grata in Richmond after the war. However, Grant and other generals see fit to send security to guard her so she's not killed. And then they feel sorry for her and want to thank her for what she did, so they make her the postmaster. So she has a salary and she's taken care of later in life, but she does pay quite a price.
You just told a mob story, and when I think about mobs in the history of this country, I don't even know what to say, and here is a mob attacking an elderly woman?
Yeah, think about it. An elderly woman who is a Richmond resident, willing to attack her and burn her house down because she allegedly helped some soldiers to escape. But, you know, thus were the feelings. And, of course, the irony is when the war's over, the Union is beginning Reconstruction. And food is being sent down and medicine's being sent down. But feelings were such and emotions were so stoked that this mob was willing to threaten the life of an elderly woman living by herself in their own native city. But fortunately, crazy bet. Elizabeth Van Loo lives through the war, lives a ripe, long life, and has the satisfaction of knowing that she has helped many men to escape. She even, when there was a descendant of Paul Revere, there was a dashing famous colonel who was tortured by the South, and they hung his body up, as a public gimmick. When people like that were buried, she would then have the former slaves that worked for her, they would go at night and dig up the body and move it to a safe location. And after the war, she notified next of kin in order that they might reinter their loved ones back home. So she continually risked her life.
That's such a remarkable story there. She had the means to do this, so she was well enough off, right?
Her father was one of, if not the wealthiest resident of Richmond, and had passed, leaving everything to her. She never married, as I noted. So she used her means to hire former slaves and allow them to live freely with her and to eat and live well, and then used her money to create this spy network. And she would have, there was one Union colonel, a big burly fellow, who was so weak that he couldn't make it to Williamsburg, which was, about 60 miles east. So one of the former slaves she had met with him, and she brought this colonel to her house and hid him in her home and fed him until the Confederate manhunt for the prisoners stopped. Once it was safe, they put him in a wagon, covered him with produce, and no one thinks of stopping an elderly woman or pretending she's crazy or a young female slave. And they took the wagon all the way east to Union lines and helped the colonel to escape. And he then meets with senior Union generals to give them the lay of Richmond and let them know all the intel that they needed. So she helped the war effort in many ways.
Well, let's say that she has this home that's at the potential end of the journey that the tunnel makers want to take. I don't know how many of them go to her place in the end. We're going to have to get back to that tunnel now and talk about its digging. You say that they procured whatever implements they were able to find. This, of course, had to be done in secrecy. And the obstacles there were probably too many to count, but you do delineate there's a number of them, just like oxygen. How do you get oxygen?
Oh, yeah, there's some great stories. So the tunnel is so long and so deep underground that when Colonel Rose, the big fella, is in there digging, he steals a jackknife, he steals a small pick. He's in there digging. You run into a number of problems. What do you do with all the dirt and rock? So Andrew Hamilton, his assistant, the major, is pretty innovative. They steal a spittoon, they steal some rope, and they create like a pulley system where Rose would fill the spittoon up with dirt, yank on the rope, Hamilton would pull it out, empty it, and then Rose would pull it back in so you didn't have to come in and out, in and out. And then Hamilton rigged up sort of a crude fan that he would fan air into the tunnel. If he didn't, the candle would go out and Rose would pass out from a lack of oxygen. So there were so many obstacles. Of course, the cave-ins of the tunnel. At one point, they were trying to dig into a sewer because that could get them out to the river. The sewer caved in on Rose, and he almost drowns in feces and urine. Now he smells of it, so he can't immediately go back upstairs to the prison. At another point, they're digging, and they run into a huge foundation. And with a jackknife and a little pick, you can't possibly dig through the massive pillars of a huge warehouse. So they try and try and try again, and they have to keep their heads up. At one point, there's a surprise roll call in the middle of the night. The problem is one of the diggers is stuck downstairs, one of the men helping them named Johnston. So he misses the roll call. If he shows up the next day for the next roll call, they'll know, the Confederate warden will know something's up. So Johnston has the horrible fate. He has to live in the dungeon. Now, it's not just any dungeon. It's pitch black, and it's nicknamed Rat Hell. It's covered with swarms of rats and the sewer. So Johnston has to live day and night for days in this pitch black sewer overrun by rats. And what Rose and Hamilton have to do then is the meager rations they get, which are not enough to keep themselves alive. It's a slow death. They have to save some of the rations and sneak them down to Johnston at night so he can eat. And at one point, Johnston's in the rat hell, this dungeon, and there's rumors of a breakout. So the Confederate guards did what they almost never did. They broke into the basement. And Johnston runs. There's a large straw pile. He dives into this pile of straw, and the guards are walking around the basement with lanterns. There's no other place to hide. Then they start poking in the straw with their bayonets. Fortunately, every bayonet misses him. He's thinking, oh, my gosh, am I lucky? Then the door opens up, and the guards come in with a bloodhound. The dog makes a beeline directly for the straw. Johnston's done. But as the dog arrives to the straw, one of the swarms of rats, one of the rats goes running out of the straw. The dog chases the rat, and the guards think, oh, there were just rats under the straw, so they leave. And, you know, so by the skin of his teeth, by luck, Johnston survives. I'm happy to say he made it out of the tunnel and would ultimately survive the war. But so there were just all these, you know, when I was researching this and reading the diaries, the accounts, the letters of these men who lived, fought, suffered, and died in that prison, you know, it read like a novel, you know, with the twists and turns. But ultimately, the bitter cold evening of February 9th, 1864, 109 men break out, making it perhaps the largest prison break in American history, the largest of the Civil War. Only 70-some men broke out of that great escape during World War II from Stalag Luft III, the Nazi camp. So this is way bigger than even that. And some live, some die, some get recaptured. So the latter part of the book is the story of these men breaking out and going on the run.
Yeah. Now, some of them run, obviously, to the plantation, to the Crazy Bat's place, right?
Right.
But I can't imagine that it's very well organized. I can't imagine that there were enough of the prisoners in the know about it that everybody was on the same page.
You know, they tried to organize it. Rose and Hamilton organized it by saving a little bit of the barely edible, meager rations that they got because they knew they'd be on the run. They tried to swap with other prisoners for boots, shoes. Even in the days leading up to it, they practiced walking around. They would walk around these big warehouse rooms to try to build their strength and endurance so that they could go on the run. They got the intel from Elizabeth Van Loo, so they knew that Williamsburg was in Union hands, and the James River pretty much flows down to Williamsburg. If anybody's there today, you can just take the Virginia Capitol Trail and you can retrace their steps. So then the question is, how do you make it 60 miles? They have to follow the river, but they have to run at night and hide during the day. And these are men that are skeletal to begin with. Rose had tried to escape early on and jumped off of a moving train when he was first captured and broke his ankle. So he's running on a broken foot. So those two, Rose and Hamilton, had some idea what they were doing and had exercised and planned for it. Other men just heard there was a tunnel and literally with whatever they had on or weren't wearing, they literally went running and it was just mayhem. They didn't know where they were going. And thus about half of them escape and about half are recaptured. So it was mayhem beyond the original planners of the escape.
So even Rose himself is recaptured.
Yeah, I didn't want that to happen when I was first reading his memoir and that of Hamilton, his partner, and others. Rose is a very likable and intriguing person. He is a school teacher from Pennsylvania who becomes a principal. He is an absolute beast on the battlefield. He's the type of officer who rises right up to colonel because he leads from the front. In pivotal moments of battle, the Confederates are breaking through the Union line. He races with a few men to try to plug the line. He's out front giving orders with the sword. I mean, Rose is a really compelling character. He's captured, and when he's captured, he tries to escape, as I said, by jumping off a train. A few of the men didn't know what to make of Rose. As the prisoners are being marched through Richmond, they run this gauntlet from the train station to Libby, where the Confederates, the citizens are on either side, they're throwing garbage on them. They're screaming at them. Even women and older folks are running up, yelling at the guards, murder them, kill them now, shoot them, hang them. And the soldiers are scared to death, the prisoners. They think they're going to be torn limb from this mob of rowdy, angry, you know, Virginians as they're being marched to Libby. But then they look at Rose. And if he's hit by garbage, he's unfazed. He's staring straight ahead, just walking on this broken ankle. People run up saying they're going to kill him, and he doesn't even blink. What they don't know is Rose is memorizing the number of steps from the train station to the prison. He's memorizing the name of every street. He's looking for where there are lanterns, where it would be lit at night, where there's a hiding place. He's looking for Confederate pickets, where there might be a group of soldiers guarding the city. So he memorizes the city as he gets there. When he gets into the prison, they take his clothes, his jacket, they're beating him. And Rose is just like a granite stone because he's focused on his escape. So he's got that will to live. It takes him over a week running by night, hiding by day. He's almost recaptured. He narrowly avoids another guard. He tricks someone. It's this harrowing tale. He finally gets to Williamsburg, and he's in the tree line, and there's a broad, open field in front of him. He knows if he runs across the field, he can get there, but what if there are Confederates in the woods, and they're on horseback, and he can't run fast because of his ankle. So he hides for some time, even though he's starving, he's dying, and he can see the fires from the camps on the Union line on the other side of the field. He can smell the burning wood and the food. Finally satisfied after hours that there's no Confederates nearby, then he starts sneaking across the field, gets halfway across, and a handful of Confederate soldiers jump up and aim their guns at him. They were hiding in the high grass to give the early warning if the Union marched westward from Richmond from Williamsburg to Richmond. They capture Rose. Rose fights and beats the you-know-what out of one of them, but then they hit him over the head with a musket. They take him back to Libby, where he's beaten again. He's put in solitary in a cell in the dungeon. I don't know how the man survived it, quite frankly, but his will to live, he lives through it and lives through the war. Rose stays in uniform. He re-ups and re-enlists, of course. That's the way he is. Rises to the rank of general and spends a lifetime in uniform, and I'm happy to say this great Colonel Rose lives a long and productive life.
Wow. These events in history, you try to paint a picture of them. You do your best. I know people like you are all about remembrance, that we don't lose hold of these stories. At the end of the day, is this really a tale of heroism first and foremost, or is it something else?
Good point. I think with all my books, whether I'm looking at military history or social history or no matter what I'm looking at, they're all a cautionary tale. And I hope people realize that the lessons of history, are something we need to heed. And if not, we'll repeat the mistakes of history. But, in times of war, war brings out the best in humanity and the worst in humanity. The same is true with prisons. I was struck by the best and the worst of humanity come out of this prison, that these men that were humiliated, that were beaten and tortured, murdered, and then made fun of as animals in a zoo, that they somehow had the will to live through this and managed against all odds to build this tunnel, dig this tunnel and escape. Yet at the same time, the worst of humanity is on display as the guards mock these men and torture them and arbitrarily just, do whatever evil they can to them. So you really see the best and the worst of humanity, this sort of duality running through the book. And it's also a lesson from history that it's still happening today all around the world. It's happened throughout history. And, one hopes that at some point we will begin to treat prisoners or our quote-unquote enemies. And I'm not naive. I've written enough books about military history. You have to win the war. I'm not naive. But that you would think that some humanity would be injected into the equation and that it would ultimately carry the day. I'm not necessarily confident, but I continue to try to write my books with those cautionary tales throughout. So, on one level, I try to bring the life of an important and fascinating story below the scenes, though. The books are always filled with lessons and tales. So,
such an important story. It's titled Escape, the story of the Confederacy's infamous Libby Prison and the Civil War's largest jailbreak. We've been speaking with historian and writer Robert P. Watson. You can learn about him at robertwatson.net. Robert, thank you for being with us today.
Marcus, it's a real pleasure, and thank you for what you do.
A prison break is one kind of escape, but if the prison is the institution of slavery, Well, the details are going to be far more complicated than just getting out of a place. There's the whole business of getting out of the social confines as well as the physical confines. We have in store for you another story of escape during the time of the Civil War and escape from slavery. We're going to revisit the story of Robert Smalls. Smalls was an enslaved man. He took over a Confederate ship and in the process freed 16 other enslaved people. Robert Smalls, a force to be reckoned with. I'm Marcus Smith, and you're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. This hour of our show has a theme. It's escaping. The first story, escaping from prison. Our next story, escaping from slavery. Here's part of a conversation I had with Douglas Edgerton. Edgerton's a history professor at Le Moyne College. We spoke about Robert Smalls, who was a slave who escaped to freedom and went on to help the cause of the Union. Eventually, Robert Smalls went on to have quite a career in public service. We began the conversation with the business of the escape. Now, a person cannot sneak away with a Confederate ship from Charleston Harbor, safely deliver a cargo of 16 slaves to freedom in the North, and not go down in history as gutsy. I just can't get over the fact that he did this. And yet, it seems like his story isn't very well known. Am I wrong about that?
No, it's not. Oddly, there's been some talk recently of a Robert Smalls movie, and I hope that happens. But you're right. It's a fascinating story. He was born in 1839 in Beaufort, and of course we tend to think of slaves as picking cotton, but slaves did a variety of things in the South. And his owner owned a shipping company, so he was an enslaved ship's pilot, so he knew how to use watercraft, and that was how they got out of Charleston in 1862. There was a ship called the Planter being used by the Confederates to essentially ferry things around in the inland waterways in Charleston Harbor, which is being blocked by the U.S. Navy. And he waited until three Confederates on the ship got off, and he and seven other enslaved people working on the ship, you know, left port, stopped and picked up their wives. He had a wife and a child. He had two children, but one had passed away. They picked up their wives, and he did the signals to get out of Charleston Harbor, and it was 4:30 in the morning, so it was dark in April. He had his master's hat, so he pulls the hat down kind of over his face, and as they go by the Fort Wagner and Fort Sumter and the other Confederate batteries, he's doing the signals, so they let him go. But just as he gets, and of course they're flying the South Carolina flag, just to get outside the harbor, the U.S. Navy is lowering the cannon to like blow them out of the water. And so they pull down really quickly the flag and put up the white flag and surrender. But he comes within a few inches of being, you know, shot by U.S. Naval forces. So it's a very courageous thing. It was a risk. And he risked himself and his family, but he succeeded.
Well, don't leave us out in the open seas. Tell us where that ship goes from there. He surrenders to the North.
He turns it over to the U.S. Navy and becomes, you know, a huge celebrity all across the North and travels to Philadelphia, travels to Washington, speaks with President Lincoln. And this is before the Emancipation Proclamation. Again, this is April of 62. Emancipation Proclamation is not till the following September, and then the final deadline for the Emancipation is January 1st of 63. And black men across the North are trying to enlist at this point, and the Lincoln administration is turning them down, insisting this is a white man's war. So it becomes actually kind of a cause for abolitionists who are pushing Lincoln, for black activists like Frederick Douglass, to start using black forces. So he actually does become, essentially, he works for the U.S. Navy. He pilots other ships all around the South. He never actually has a kind of a formal title or a rank. But he is technically sort of one of the first African-Americans to work for U.S. Armed Forces in the Civil War.
And he comes with deep knowledge about what it's like down there in Charleston, too. And I would imagine that would be of, you know, use to the North.
Oh, sure. And of course, the U.S. Army and Navy are trying to get into Charleston Harbor, which the North regards as, I mean, of course, you know, the capital is Richmond, but the North regards Charleston as being sort of the heart and soul of secession, pro-slavery, and they really want to capture it. And of course, it's not until finally the big battle of Fort Wagner, when the first time black troops attack Confederate forces just outside of Charleston, that's not till July of 63. So it's not till then September that Wagner falls, and so Charleston doesn't fall itself until early 65. So having a guy who knows all the back waterways, I mean, not just the harbor, but how you get around, how you go up Stono River and then turn around this marsh. And the Planter has it's a very flat ship, so it can sail on very, very, not deep water. So having someone who knows that kind of information is really, really helpful to U.S. forces.
And you got to know the shoals and the shallows to not get stranded in a place like that. Yeah, so Robert Smalls then is with the Navy of the North, and I can only imagine that it was with great trepidation that he would go back down into the same waters down near Charleston. Sure. If he had been caught, I would imagine that the Confederacy would have recognized him.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, there was a magazine at the time called The Nation, which was kind of the Time or Newsweek of its day. And, of course, it didn't have photographs, but it had really pretty detailed artwork. And so there were pictures of Smalls. It was very distinctive looking. He was a pretty burly guy, mustache, kind of a Van Dyke sort of goatee. At the very least, of course, he would have been re-enslaved. And the worst case, of course, is that something else would have happened to him. He would have been incarcerated in the workhouse or something like that.
Or executed.
Davis had threatened to sell into slavery black men caught in blue uniforms and to summarily execute white officers leading black men into battle, people like Rob Shaw in Massachusetts. So, the safe thing to do would be, and again, his wife was out, his child was out, stay in Philadelphia. But he put his life on the line to help liberate 4 million enslaved Americans.
So in Philadelphia, he learns to read?
He was, and of course, only four states in the South flatly banned literacy for slaves, although certainly everybody else frowned on it. There were no schools for slaves. So he was acutely aware that he was in a bad place because he was not literate. And from the time he became free, for about the next 10 years, he spent 2 hours a night, with a grade school primer, learning how to read, practicing speeches. He became a very formidable orator later in life. He was a man on the go. I mean, he wanted to go back to the South after the war. That's what he knew.
He escapes to the North with his wife. He is able to learn how to read. And then at the end of the war, having served during the war for the Union as a pilot for the remainder of the Civil War, then he has to find something new to do. And Douglas Edgerton, he goes back to South Carolina, and he actually purchases the mansion that had belonged to his deceased master. That's got to feel good.
Yeah, that's a great story. And the house, by the way, is I wouldn't call it a mansion. It's a very nice house, but it's still there. It has a historical marker on it. It's currently actually privately owned, but you can sort of walk in front of it. And, of course, he's buried in Beaufort. But he has, again, he's got this chunk of money that he takes back and starts a business. And interestingly, the business he starts with is with a guy named Joseph Rainey, who actually becomes the first black congressman in American history, elected in 1870.
That's got to be his point of entree into the idea of a public career. I would imagine Rainey influenced
him. Sure, yeah. And they both become Republicans, which, of course, is the party of Lincoln. And a lot of rail lines had been torn up in South Carolina toward the end of the war. And so they had 18 miles of track connecting Charleston to several ports and docks and hinterland. It started pretty small. So it's on a track, but it's carts being pulled by horses, moving freight. They make money doing that, and then he discovers that his now deceased master's house had been seized toward the end of the war for non-payment of federal taxes, and it's going to be sold at an estate sale. So he buys the house. He liked it. He knows it was home for him, and he moved in. And the best part of the story is that his former master's wife, whose name was Jane McKee, she was still alive, and she was a little bit older, and she was a little dotty. And one day she just came home. She thought she was home. It was, her house. So what does Smalls do? He takes her in, gives her a room. He lets her live there rent-free until the day she dies.
Wow.
So, he's a man of enormous humanity. You know, we would think that somebody who was so brutalized as being a thing, being chattel, being property, but he was a man of great humanity, and took her in. That's for me. That's one of the great stories of Reconstruction.
He is there in Beaufort in South Carolina, a businessman, and is also involved at some point, and this is a nice way to get into politics too. He was involved with a newspaper.
Sure. I mean, a lot of these guys are kind of jack of all trades politically. They're in business. They're on school boards because, of course, they want to have good schools. And he's pushing really hard for the first ever public and integrated schools in South Carolina. There were no free schools for free white kids before the war. Starts a newspaper, and unfortunately, no copies of that paper today exist. It was a short run, and even the Library of Congress doesn't have that run. But you know, it's a way to get your name out. It's a way to kind of push your position. Quite often in the South, the second that a city was occupied by U.S. forces, New Orleans as early as 62, a black-owned paper pops up to kind of push, you know, that agenda. So he's got his finger in a lot of political pies.
Now, at some point, he's in Washington then because locally he's able to be elected. And I want to know about what he does in D.C. What does he do at the nation's capital? He manages to keep his seat through multiple sessions of Congress.
Yeah, and I should say, actually, first he's also in the State House. He gets elected first in 68 to the State House, and then from 70 to 75 he's in the State Senate. And that's when he is then elected to – it's kind of two long periods in Washington. He's first elected in 75, serves two terms, is back in 82 until 87. And what's really interesting is that he's the 14th black member from the South in Congress. So he's not the first or the second. He's the 14th. None of these guys are single-issue congressmen. They're pushing for a broad agenda. And, of course, then or now, you know, money follows power. So you know, I came across stories where on any given day, a black constituent might come to his office, but there's also a white businessman because he's in Congress. And so that's the guy you go and talk to. So he's pushing for a variety of things. And obviously part of this is the African-American agenda, you know, good schools for the kids, that kind of thing. But also voting rights, segregation battles start essentially the moment the war is over, so he's fighting against those kinds of things. But also just for kind of nuts and bolts economic things, harbor improvements, river improvements to help the upcountry in South Carolina, railroads, things like that. So he's not just the black congressman. He's the South Carolina congressman. And what's really interesting is because, again, that was one of the states, Mississippi was the other, that had a black majority. When he's in Congress, they've got four members of Congress and three are black. So finally, South Carolina has a congressional delegation that looks like the state.
Douglas Edgerton, a history professor at Lemoyne College, talking about Robert Smalls, a man who stole a ship to escape slavery.